I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
And John O'Neill, who was the FBI chief of counterterrorism, you had this to say about him. Mr. O'Neill was interested only in furthering his career and disguising the rank and competence of senior FBI leaders.
Yes, sir. I think I also said that the only good thing that happened to America on 11 September was that the building fell on him, sir.
Okay.
The audio you just heard was a clip that will set the stage for this edition of Parallax Views, a special released on the 18th anniversary of September 11th, 2001, the day that America was hit by the worst terrorist attack in its history. In that clip, you could hear former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, Michael Schuer, voicing publicly, in testimony, his disdain for John O'Neill, the late national security chief of the FBI, sometimes referred to as Bin Laden's arch nemesis, who perished in the World Trade Center on that fateful September day. It is my opinion that that audio clip serves to perfectly illustrate the battles between American intelligence agencies both before and after the events of September 11th, 2001. 18 years onward, the deep history of 9/11 reveals systemic and structural failures of the American national security state that to this day remain unaccounted for. Or so argues our guests on this edition of Parallax Views, Ray Novoshowski and John Duffy, authors of last year's hit 9/11 book, The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, The CIA, NSA, and the Crimes of the War on Terror. When the book was released last year, it garnered attention from outlets such as Jacobin and Salon. Moreover, it was particularly noted for featuring the testimony of Richard A. Clark, National Coordinator for Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Counterterrorism from 1998 to 2003. And folks, his testimony in this book is explosive. Now, the conversation you are about to hear is previously unpublished. It ran into a number of technical difficulties, but I felt it was time to pull the trigger. There are some audio dropouts, but I have done as much as I can to alleviate any issues with the audio, and I think the episode, the conversation, is eminently listenable. So, without further ado, my previously unpublished conversation with Ray Novoshowski and John Duffy, the authors of The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, The CIA, NSA, and the Crimes of the War on Terror. Welcome to Parallax Views, John Duffy and Ray Novoshowski.
Hey, JDG. Thanks for having us. Very cool. A lot of folks not having us on, so really appreciate you giving us some time to, you know, talk.
So you guys have a new book out called Watchdogs Don't Bark, and the subtitle is The CIA, NSA, and the Crimes of the War on Terror. And I guess the first thing we can get into is, you know, we were talking about it before we went live, is a lot of people are covering this book as a book that's simply about 9/11 and the intelligence failures of 9/11. But I think there's a lot more to it than that. Could you expand on what you were trying to accomplish with this book?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I was kind of saying it's so we wrote The Watchdogs Didn't Bark in part. Because back in 2011, we discovered a person who'd been alleged to be a massive human rights abuser, connected to a lot of things, including the 9/11 failure, named Alfreda Frances Bukowski, who's still co-running the war on terror at the CIA. And even though a few outlets, Gawker, one of them, Salon being another, reported on Alfreda, to date, she's never been reported on by the New York Times. And she's gotten one passing mention in the Washington Post and so on and so forth. Never a TV mention outside of RT. So I didn't want to let that stand personally. Duffy may have his own motivations for why he took on the book. But that, among a number of other things, like the fact that Richard Clark had told us back in 2009 in an on-camera interview, accused his old friend George Tenet, former head of the CIA, of malfeasance and misfeasance in the run-up to the launch of the war on terror, in the run-up to 9/11. Things like that, that like had kind of come out and made, we thought, were pretty significant news stories and were like just media bait for places like the New York Times and the Washington Post. And then to see years go by and they not report on what I think is the most incredible story I'm aware of, we decided to go ahead and this book. But I guess the thing that's been sort of bothering me a little bit, I've got a sense of humor about it, but for years and years and years, we were trying to tell the story of this intelligence failure before 9/11. And in the Bush era, and even in the early Obama era, none of the mainstream media wanted to go there. They didn't want to cover the 9/11 topic. Now, far enough in the past that nothing can really be done, for the most part, maybe I'm wrong, regarding accountability for those failures. Suddenly now we put this book out, and it's the headline. It's all he wants to talk about. Whereas I see some other elements of the book, like Alfreda, like some of the lost parts of like the NSA 5, you know, people like Tom Drake's story of why they were gone after, people like John Kiriakou, why he was gone after. One story that almost nobody knows about, Mark Rossini and the FBI and the evidence that, you know, he was sort of a whistleblower of the war on terror that's been overlooked, who was gone after possibly because he wanted to talk with reporters. So, you know, these are the things that I keep praying the mainstream media or folks like you will kind of like let us focus in on a little bit. But the 9/11 stuff is really interesting and enticing, and it's still worth, you know, talking about.
And if I may, I think when I took on the project of the book, you know, Ray will often say this is not a 9/11 book, or meaning it's not just a 9/11 book. And Ray really tries to sell this is an accountability book. It's showing how leaving people in their positions of power who do fucked up stuff. I hope I can swear. Sorry. Leaving people in positions of power who do bad things just creates a situation where they do more bad things. And I think on that, I wanted to kind of make it apparent that this is a product of large state systems and that this is not unique. You can look at example after example throughout U.S. history, whether you want to focus on just national security, you want to look at, you know, if you want to look at like the Iran-Contra affair, whatever, you know, just pick your time period, pick your event, you're going to find a lot of people who are involved in these positions of power at in the intelligence community who can get away with committing what are essentially crimes or, you know, lying about it after the fact, and how maybe you have a handful of show trials or some you know, lip service towards reform, but ultimately we have these big systems where the bad actors, so, you know, in quotes, continue to get away with it and to move up the ladder, move up the chain of command, and people who try to blow the whistle or stop this are often steamrolled, prosecuted, thrown under the bus in a variety of ways. So it's not just 9/11. It's not just the war on terror. This is the way a massive empire functions, and you can change some deck chairs, you can rearrange a few pieces of, you know, a few faces, oh, now this guy's in charge, oh, now that lady is in charge, but ultimately the machine itself is going to continue functioning the way it does, which is why in the intro to the book it says the purpose of a system is what it does. So I want people to look bigger, I want people to look at system wide, and like the events in the book are the case study. You can see how it worked here, you can see how the media played its role here, you can see how justice failed here, but now apply that to the larger system as a whole.
By the way, JG, I think I'm a little more optimistic, or some might say naive, than Duffy. So, I wouldn't want to be so nihilistic about the understanding about large systems that we disregard that things could function better than you know. For instance, in the book, we lay out all of these mechanisms that have been created, you know, with good intentions to try to catch bad actors within the governments, from, you know, federal and state prosecutors and laws that exist, as well as like inspector generals that were put into offices, you know, into agencies. The leadership of each of those agencies themselves are supposed to be accountability mechanisms. The presidents are supposed to be. The intelligence committees of Congress, which didn't exist for the first couple decades that the intelligence community existed, but they got the good idea to add them. I mean, I can't imagine how corrupt things would be if those mechanisms didn't exist. And I think we should try to encourage further mechanisms. And I think the number one thing you can do if you want to battle corruption is to hold people to account when they're caught in corruption, because that lets the next set of folks who get the weird orders go, I didn't really like what happened to the guys that got asked to do XYZ 10 years ago, so I think I'm going to not do that. In fact, I think I'm going to go to the media and tell them to ask me that, you know? So I'm just putting that out there.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I want to get into that systems talk a little bit more, but first I want to deal with the first chapter of the book, because it's really riveting, and it sort of centers around Richard Clark, and you briefly mentioned Clark earlier. A lot of my audience is younger, so they may actually not even know who Richard Clark is. So if you could like tell me and my listeners a little bit more about Richard Clark for those who are on that younger side of things that don't even necessarily have like a strong memory of all this post 9/11 stuff.
Yeah, Richard Clark served under both President Bill Clinton and then President George W. Bush in a role that was colloquially referred to as the White House counter-terror czar. So basically, he is the top guy working directly for the presidential administration regarding counter-terror. So he is talking with people across government, collecting information to then bring recommendations and such to the president regarding the issue of terrorism. And again, he had this job prior to 9/11. And then he came sort of to big public acclaim during the 9/11 commission when he, you know, he sat down and he read a statement in which he apologized to the families of people who died on 9/11. He basically said, you know, your government failed you and I failed you. He wrote a book at the time called Against All Enemies that went into a lot of detail of what was going on behind the scenes in the lead up to 9/11. And then he eventually retired from government service He now works in the private sector doing like cybersecurity work.
The former head of the FBI, Louis Freeh, sort of derisively referred to him as the self-appointed Paul Revere of 9/11. And there has been a lot, I want to acknowledge, there's been a bit of controversy around him as to whether he would fall into the quote-unquote good guys or the bad guys. There's sort of no doubt from pretty much everyone we talk to that he, along with CIA Director George Tenet and maybe a few other folks within the higher levels of the government, were really the only ones who really kind of understood and got what a threat Al-Qaeda was in the years before 9/11. And so there's questions about responsibility, who knew what when, who was on the right side and the wrong side of decisions that were made there.
And you guys actually, in that first chapter, you talk about meeting with Richard Clark for an interview. What did you guys learn from Clark in that interview that other journalists may not have gotten out of him?
Rip, you want to field that one right here?
I'm sorry about that. The phone was on mute. Sorry. Yeah, I could definitely take that. So, you know, the thing was that he had left government service a year or so after 9/11. He claimed after the fact, when he wrote Against All Enemies, that he left essentially because he was sort of secretly disgusted at the time by the push for war in Iraq by the Bush administration, and that he, you know, everybody essentially knew that it was a total con job, and that there was no reason to be going into Iraq at that time, no relation to 9/11. So he'd blown the whistle on that in 2004 when he went before the commission. And then a number of years passed, and he had written a book that came out in 2008. And what's important to sort of understand, and I'll just sort of like jump to the end here, is like a lot of people will ask why Clark told us what I'm about to tell you about. And they seem to think he sort of came out of nowhere and told it to us. But that actually wasn't the case. The fact was that the people who testified before the various government investigations in the first few years after 9/11 had done a pretty good job, and in particular George Tenet and the folks at the CIA, but also NSA, had done a really good job of keeping the real skeletons kind of under wraps that would have pointed back to massive failures or worse by them and their people. And Richard Clark, by and large, as you know, was getting the same information we were getting post 9/11. So he was relying on those investigations. And when he didn't see anything really significant emerge, he just assumed it had gone pretty much the way those investigations said. But there was one report that had been kept under wraps, and it was CIA Inspector General did an internal review at what had gone wrong at CIA, a guy named John Helgerson. And I believe it was 2007, about 2 years after he finished his final version of his report, a couple of congressmen, managed to push out the executive summary of that report into the public. And the executive summary completely contradicted what George Tenet had previously testified. He was asked about some cables about the future 9/11 hijackers that had come into his CIA's ALEC station, the Bin Laden unit, back in 2000. And those cables had very clearly warned, that one of the future hijackers had a U.S. visa likely coming to America. Another one clearly warned that another future 9/11 hijacker had actually arrived already in Southern California. And both had been surveilled by CIA attending a top Al-Qaeda summit, which was known at the time. So these guys were known to be bad dudes. So Tenet had been asked, people can Google this video, why would this cable have come in and nobody do anything about this? And he said, I know that nobody read that cable in that March 2000 timeframe. It was information only and nobody read it. And Clark believed that until the John Helgerson CIA IG report executive summary came out in 2007. And what that report said was that 50 to 60 people in CIA, many of them in this Bin Laden unit, had read one or more of the cables pertaining to these bad Al-Qaeda actors' travel to the United States in 2000. So Clark reads that and he flips out. But the thing is, nobody was asking him about that. So what does he do? It's another book. Now, he doesn't devote the whole thing to that. He was already working on a book, but he writes a book called Your Government Failed You. And he includes this whole, I think he included like 6 pages where he just takes this sudden left turn in the book and says, by the way, before we leave this 9/11 topic, I got to talk about this because I don't believe in conspiracy theories, but this one, I just cannot make sense. You know, he titles it Straining Credulity. And so we were the only guys who bothered to call, like we apparently were the only ones who read it and thought, hey, I'd like to ask him some more questions about that. So in October of 2009, he agreed to a sit-down interview to our great astonishment. And we brought our two cameras in, and we sat there, and we were trying to get a bigger documentary made. So released the interview in edited form until summer of 2011, just before the 9/11 anniversary. And that's a long buildup to what did he tell us? We sit down with him, and what he says is that there was an information machine that was constantly feeding him information about terror alerts, this exact kind of thing about these two hijackers coming to the U.S. But never, ever did he or any of his team receive that information. He further said that there was no barrier between George Tenet and the counterterror al-Qaeda folks, the Alex Station folks, that Tenet was in the weeds, that he was checking in, he would read a cable, and he would call up his buddy Richard Clark to tell him about some little piece of minutia so they could get on top of it. So Tenet was very much in the loop, and he was very much feeding he and his team everything they had to Richard Clark, except for this. And then he lays out, the logical next question that everybody asks is, well, then why would they withhold this? And he had a theory, and he laid it out for us, and we can get into that. But the big headline to me was that, guys at Clark's level don't often accuse guys at Tenet's level of malfeasance and misfeasance. Those are very specific legal terms, and he accused him of it. He said the only thing that he could make sense of it is that they withheld this information, and he gave the reason why he thought that was, and he thought it amounted to malfeasance and misfeasance on the part of Tenet, and that Tenet essentially put his own ass ahead of national security, and 9/11 was the result.
So what was, since you mentioned that we could get into what Clark's theory was, doesn't it have to do with trying to sort of recruit these people into the CIA? I think the two characters are Hosni and Bindar, right?
Almidar, yeah. So you have these two fellas, Khalid Almidar, Nawaf al-Hosni. They had been affiliated with al-Qaeda for a hot minute. They had fought in like Chechnya. And basically, this information all starts coming out of this house in Yemen. So in Yemen, there's a house in a city called Sana'a, and the house is owned by bin Laden's buddy, a man named Ahmed al-Hada, and that happens to be Khalid al-Midar's father-in-law. So you can't, at this point in time, direct calls to and out of Afghanistan were really possible. Now, bin Laden did have a satellite phone, but in order to really transmit information around the world to their global network, they used this house in Yemen to, as a switchboard, to pass information and, as a safe house. So because of the tracking of his satellite phone, the NSA gets wind of this house in Yemen. The NSA is basically is listening to all the phone calls that go into and out of this house for years. And they have a person whose specific job is to just, listen to this house. And then later, CIA gets wind of this when Alex Station was under Mike Scheuer. And they have a little squabble over getting access to the information, but ultimately the CIA is getting a bunch of the information out of this house in Sana'a. And they recognize that there's going to be some big meeting right around the time of the millennium. So right around the beginning of the year 2000, there's going to be a big meeting in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And it's going to be basically an al-Qaeda planning summit. They're going to get a bunch of guys together. It's a pitch session. We're going to pitch ideas on what to blow up and who's going to be involved and how to do it. And so the CIA's attention to this, they get the assistance of a handful of other intelligence agencies from other countries to assist them. And in transit, Khalid al-Midar on his way there stops in Dubai, and in his hotel room, basically the CIA has somebody break into this room. They see his passport, they take pictures of it, they send those pictures back to station at CIA, and it turns out he has a visa to travel to the United States. So that's like a big red alert thing right there. They got this guy known al-Qaeda. He's been in the field for them. He's attached very closely to bin Laden, and here he is planning to come to the United States. So he's going to be traveling in after this meeting's over. Nawaf al-Hosni comes with him. They end up setting up shop in California. They land in L.A., but they quickly make it down to San Diego. And all of this it's being monitored by the CIA up to a point, but then they sort of claim that they lose these guys in Bangkok. But the point of all of this is that Clark's theory is that when the CIA sees these guys coming to the United States, that they get this aha moment where they figure maybe they could try to flip these dudes. And by flip them, it probably doesn't mean start being just direct employees of the CIA on the CIA payroll. it would probably have been done via Saudi proxies. And what that would have meant would have been like, it would have not necessarily even been like, oh, these guys are now necessarily even double agents. But what they would do is they would get them in close with some like secret Saudi spies that these guys wouldn't even know were Saudi spies necessarily, who would then start getting information out of them, passing it back to Alex Station in the hopes of doing whatever. So this is Clark's theory, that the CIA was trying to use these guys operating domestically, and that when it worked, didn't work, whatever, at some point it all goes wrong, and instead of passing this information on over to law enforcement to go arrest these guys or do whatever, they sort of just sit quietly and hope it goes away at a certain level, and then it all blows up big time when these dudes crash a plane into the Pentagon, and their homies crash planes into other places.
And for those of your audience, you mentioned they're younger, who likely have no idea, you know, who George Tenet is. I think he's probably most famous for going along with George W. Bush down that and enabling that rabbit hole that was Iraq, which, you know, gave us everything we're still dealing with in the Middle East today. But the Trumper folks among your audience might find it interesting to know that that John Brennan, before he joined George Tenet's team, had been the chief of station in Saudi Arabia. And both Brennan and Tenet had strong relationship with Saudi Arabia, as reported by many people. And Brennan had gone on to be deputy director to Tenet from 96 to 99. And then those last 2 years up until 9/11 was Tenet's chief of staff. So if Richard Clark's allegations are in fact correct, and in the book we support them with quite a number of other individuals who've come forward to us, then it seems highly likely that John Brennan would have been in the loop on that.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting with Tenet, because I think there's one point in the book where you talk about Tenet's sort of I don't know if it's his early years, but Tenet in the 90s, I guess he was having to defend the CIA during a rather difficult time for the CIA. Could you get into that a little bit? Because I think it ties into this issue of accountability. It seems like people were wanting to hold the CIA accountable in you know, previous eras, and now we're just seeing these intelligence agencies and the sort of national security state run rampant.
Yeah, I'd love to address that one, actually, because one thing we go into in the book very briefly, in other books, History of Ashes,
Legacy of Ashes.
Legacy of Ashes. Thank you. Have gone much deeper into this sort of thing. But, you know, I think it's important for modern audiences to realize that the CIA didn't exist prior to 1947 until we ended World War II. There was a forerunner to it during World War II. But, you know, largely, by and large, civilian intelligence agencies during non-wartime were considered something that authoritarian countries did. Right. And you had intelligence for when you had wars, and you had it specifically to figure out what the opposing side in a war was doing before they did it, so you could counter it. And so this was a new idea that was created in 47, and in fact it was created with the signature of Harry Truman, who was incredibly reticent. You know, he was worried. He turned down the initial proposal, saying it could be an American Gestapo, which of course was something that we had just battled the Nazis. And so by the time Kennedy shot, there's this really astounding op-ed that Truman feels the need to write. I think it was just like a month later, where he kind of says, looking at everything that's come out about, you know, the agency that I created, I'm paraphrasing here, but looking at everything that we know, it seems clear that this is not serving its original intention, which was that the president needed something better than just what the newspapers could provide to keep up on the info, that he needed some inside info, that he needed some really smart people all working in an agency feeding him the president's newspaper. But it had turned into more than that. It turned into this sort of covert ops arm that was doing these terrible things around the world. Well, of course, nobody heeded Harry Truman's op-ed. But after Watergate, a lot more people were willing to acknowledge that maybe the government does some things we don't want it to do in secret. And so there was a whole series of hearings in Congress and these attempts to get to the bottom of what the spy agencies had been up to over their previous 30 years, and the most famous being the Church Committee. That and at the time, there were folks in the CIA who thought that The agency couldn't survive having their dirty secrets aired in public, that that the public backlash would see them, you know, torn apart and, you know, scattered to the winds, as supposedly John Kennedy had wanted to do before he was killed. And so, you know, jump to the future. And, you know, what in the 80s, what should have been a chastened intelligence community gets caught in Iran-Contra. And we won't get into the weeds on that one. But, you know, it started to appear that what they found to be the solution to what had happened with the Church Committee hearings was that they just needed to do more stuff off the books. And, you know, so as time gone on, there have been, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, these attempts to, you know, there was the creation of the congressional intelligence committees, which would hold the purse strings of these agencies and therefore could call them in to explain themselves. And there was the addition of these inspector generals, which is essentially, you know, police hate what they call the rat squad, you know, that comes in and kind of holds their feet to the fire after the fact. But that's essentially what the IGs were supposed to be, somebody to investigate, somebody within each agency to investigate that agency. So there have been these attempts over the years at accountability. And I think we had a really good opportunity. And if there's anything I'll never forgive George W. Bush and Dick Cheney for, is blowing the opportunity. If 9/11 was simply a failure that happened with the best of intentions, I think everyone in the country would have completely understood that. And that was the time to clear house, get to the bottom of what had happened. And anybody who was making decisions that weren't in the best interest of the country, but that seemed to be in the best interest of other parties or themselves or their agencies or whatever it was, and it had resulted in this terrible tragedy, that was the time to fix it. And we really had a golden opportunity to do so. But instead, you know, we show in the book, there's this moment where whatever George Tenet knew before 9/11, that he can't claim ignorance anymore as of about November 2001. For your younger audience, reminder, that's about, you know, 2 months after these terrible attacks. And his agency has been completely empowered. Everything that the different directors of CIA over the years had ever wanted a president to sign off on, he had pitched to George W. Bush in the week after 9/11, and a secret executive order had greenlit all of it. They could run the interrogations, they could torture, they could have secret prisons, you know, on and on. Assassination programs that became the drone thing. And it's November 2001, and a CIA historian is going through all the old counterterror records just to prepare Tenet for the fact there's going to be these coming government investigations, and he needs to know what they're going to find out. And the guy comes up to him, and he tells him about these cables that make it clear that so many people in his counterterror department in Alex Station, you know, knew that these two key future hijackers had arrived in the U.S. and multiple communications over a year and a half about this. And Tenet has the opportunity to hold Alfredo Bukowski, Rich Blee, maybe Kofor Black, Jennifer Matthews, Michael Ann Casey to account. But he doesn't. And he continues to put them in charge of the war on terror. And all of the fuck-ups that happen over the last 17 years, the misleading about torture, you know, the mistaking like a poor innocent German with the same name as a terrorist who gets kidnapped and held in a secret prison in Afghanistan for 5 months and on and on and on. Not all of them. But many, many, many mistakes are laid at the feet, as we show in the book, of these individuals because George Tenet didn't hold them to account in November of 2001.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because it also gets into this issue that I think younger audiences won't recognize, is that, you know, I think a lot of people forget that 9/11 didn't really happen in a vacuum. I mean, we're told that it just happened out of nowhere, you know? That's what I remember people saying when it happened, you know, on that fateful September day. But really, I mean, there were precursors to the September 11th attacks, the most famous being the 93 World Trade Center bombing. And I guess was it the 98 embassy bombing?
Mm-hmm.
I know you guys cover that a little bit in the book. Could you talk a little bit about the sort of precursor warning signs that people have sort of forgotten about?
I would be interested to like to get to spend a day as someone right now who's like 17 or 18 and to get to understand what the narrative being fed about 9/11 is to people who didn't live through it or who weren't old enough to remember it. Because I remember like in the days after, I'm going to date myself here in the Times, but I remember sitting in like AOL chat rooms where people were like freaking out about it. and like writing to people like, and again, I was like 20 years old or whatever. But I was like, guys, like, A, this is kind of blowback for all the shit we've been doing, like in the Middle East, you know, up to now. And be like, this really isn't out of nowhere. And, you know, people just, you know, condemning me outright in those AOL chat rooms. But yeah, there's been a variety of terrorist groups that have been in a variety of regions and who have had a variety of agendas, specifically, you know, with bin Laden. And the Al-Qaeda network, yeah, you go back, you have the 93 World Trade Center attack, so that happened when I was in sixth grade, actually. But yeah, these guys, they basically drove a truck bomb into the basement of the World Trade Center and detonated it, and they killed a handful of people, and I think the intention was to take out the core columns in the building where it was parked, but it stood. And that's actually, again, you can get into the weeds on any of these, and you'll find a lot of really interesting information, and I highly suggest people do that. But then you go on, and then in 1998, there was a simultaneous bombing at two African embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. Was it Kenya? Am I confused? Two embassy bombings happened.
Yeah, it was Kenya.
Yeah, I had a long night last night, so the detailed part of my brain is a little foggy. That happened, and then you had the attack on the USS Cole, which was a U.S. warship that was in port in Aden in Yemen, and these guys hopped in a little dinghy, and it was packed with explosives, and they just motored into the side of this warship and hole in the side of the warship, killed several sailors. And even in between there was a handful of foiled plots. So you had, like, the New York Bridges and Tunnels plot, you had the Bojinka plot, which tried to blow up several airliners over the Pacific Ocean at the same time. So there was a lot going on with the Al-Qaeda network. They weren't unknown, and there were a handful of people who worked in the FBI and the CIA and various agencies who were very well aware of this network and their capabilities and their intentions, and they were trying to get something done about it. To say that it was sort of out of the blue is pretty false, and especially if you look at now what we have, and we established part of this record in the book, and it's been long established prior to our book, but that these people were going with very specific warnings to, you know, the president, to the national security advisor, and things like that in the lead up to 9/11. So now what was removed was some very specific information pertaining to very specific people who had made it to the United States, including Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, which is part of what makes this all so suspicious and makes it seem like something else was at play here. For instance, you know, there's a very famous a very famous presidential daily briefing that made its way to George Bush in August of 2001, like a month before the attacks, that was titled "Bin Laden Determined to Strike Within the United States." However, the contents of that warning are sort of vague and amorphous. There's some information that had been, you know, it was kind of historical, but there's no mention of Khalid al-Midar, Nawaf al-Hazmi, their connections to the coal bombing, their connections to the terror plot summit in Malaysia, their connections to the Hada House in Yemen. So, yes, these attacks could seem like, maybe to the uninformed general public, like they were, I don't know, to anyone who is paying any moderate level of attention, no.
Well, you know, that leads me to another thing. I think when we talk about 9/11 accountability, I've noticed sometimes people try to make it into a partisan thing. I remember some years ago, there was a movie made with Harvey Keitel called Path to 9/11. It was a miniseries, and you know, Republicans latched onto it because they felt that it was sort of a blame Clinton movie, and they could get behind that. And then there's people that want to sort of lay the blame at Bush and say there were, you know, forewarnings of this. But I think that doesn't necessarily get to the heart of how, during both the Bush and Clinton years, there's this continuity of intelligence agency failures of sorts. It's not simply who is the guy that's the commander in chief that is like the number one mover and shaker behind all of this necessarily, or the only mover and shaker, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, this is not like a sexy answer, but I think it's something people need to get kind of real about, is that unfortunately, you know, I mentioned that I like these elements of systems, like adding an inspector general to an office, that like just kind of add an extra possibility that corruption might not make its way through. At the end of the day, it's up to the individuals who run certain offices, and they set the tone. And the same thing happens with the media, which is why some places cover certain things and others don't. It's not because they're getting memos every day saying don't cover X. It's because they already kind of know the tone that's been set by the boss and the issues that they're into and the things they should and shouldn't do. So what you just said makes me think of, you know, John O'Neill and the New York FBI office. And it's, you know, a lot of people might see elements of our book saying like the FBI are good guys, the CIA are bad guys. It's completely dependent on what FBI or CIA office and who's in charge of it at any given time and how good they are at setting the tone. You know, so I mentioned George Tenet and the failure to hold to account. I mean, had it been a different guy, a more ethical guy, you know, running the CIA at the time, perhaps we would have cleared house and maybe we'd have a much better functioning intelligence system right now. But yeah, the New York FBI was headed by a guy named John O'Neill. Some of his team members, the people he brought in, Mark Rossini, Ali Sufan, Jack Clunan, Dan Coleman, you know, these guys were sort of told, and there were some exceptions, but for the most part, what he tried to create was a situation pre-9/11 where, you know, they knew that they ultimately the outcome had to be that they had to be able to prosecute these guys in open court. And that was another difference. You know, there are differences between presidents. And while people might have their problems with Bill Clinton, one thing that I liked about his approach to the terrorism problem, in contrast to George W. Bush's, is that he believed in the law enforcement approach, which meant instead of sending secret operators in to kidnap people, maybe torture them, and then never try them, but just sort of disappear them, you know, off into a secret jail somewhere, he thought a better approach was that you send cops, FBI agents in, and at the time it was the New York office that was in charge of Al-Qaeda, and you have them in these terrorists, and if they can mount a case, you arrest them, and you put them on trial in many cases in the Southern District of New York in the federal courts. And so that combination, I think, created much more sunlight as a disinfectant kind of thing. But there was, yeah, so, I mean, what that makes me think of is that people like to think very black and white, and especially now in the Trump era, it's like people are really into this sort of black and white politicization. If something John Brennan says and you're a pro-Trump person, then everything John Brennan's ever done had to have been wrong and he was the bad guy and so on and so forth. The politicization of 9/11, I think, was something where you know, for instance, the Jersey Widows early on, we did it, our first exposure to these issues and this push for accountability was centered around these people who, as they put it, you know, they were living in New Jersey. Their husbands went to work one day and never came back. And they two of them had voted for Bush. One was an independent, you know, one had voted for Gore in the 2000 election. But they didn't really give a shit about any of that after they lost their husbands. What they wanted was an investigation and they wanted to see some accountability and figure out what systems went wrong and see if they couldn't go about fixing them. And that was a situation right off the bat where Republicans were sort of dead against an investigation at the time because, you know, George W. Bush was against an investigation at the time. And it's, you know, it's very odd because I think a lot of these people were probably the same folks who got super up in arms when Benghazi happened. So there is this sort of hypocrisy, and you follow these over a long enough time, and it doesn't seem like there's a consistent philosophy. There's a huge chunk of people who, you know, it's okay when my guy does it, but it's not okay when the other guy does it. You know?
If I could just quickly add to that, like you have, like you said, if someone's going to try to politicize this, what it does is it benefits the CIA or these other unelected organizations. Right. So if people want to say like it was Bush's fault, it was Clinton's fault because that aligns with their political beliefs, who benefits there? Who benefits is the people at the CIA who aren't part of either of those parties, essentially. I mean, sure, they're voters, but like the accountability is going off into this little volleyball game of who's better, team red or team blue, when really the people who are doing the heavy lifting of fucking things up are all working at this intelligence agency. They're not going to get voted out. They're not going to, you know what I'm saying? So like to play that partisan game assists in like making sure that no one who actually screws up is going to be held accountable. Now, there is this thing where presidents have approaches to how they handle the intelligence agencies. And I think if you look at our book, you'll see that Larry Wilson, who worked for Colin Powell, says that Bill Clinton's approach was he was very standoffish with the CIA, wouldn't let the director in the room. But he also had this approach where he was like, on certain matters, things like renditions, was just like, do it and don't tell me about it. He wanted his plausible deniability. But and that sort of approach kind of gives the CIA carte blanche to do what they want. He's really more worried about his own, you know, accountability than he is with what they might actually go out in the world and do. And, you know, George Bush had a different approach where he was, you know, he became very buddy-buddy with George Tenet. But still, in the end, that buddy-buddy relationship still meant signing executive orders that gave the CIA exactly what they wanted. So the political game, in the end, I think it doesn't really serve us to play that too hard when it comes to the actions taken by these unelected bureaucrats who sit in positions of power.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was getting at. I think a lot of these problems actually transcend the president because, you know, presidents come and go, but, you know, a lot of the people in the CIA and the intelligence agencies, they stay around a lot longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, me and Ray play this game where we wait to see who's going to answer the question first. So that's pretty much what I was saying. If anyone, if you just play, you know, the focus on the president game, that's awesome because then for 4 years you can direct all of your vitriol and all of your angst at this particular person, and then wash your hands of it a few years later, and then get mad at the next person or get mad at the next person, and instead of seeing like, oh, like. This is a revolving door of sort of faces, but the real mechanisms of the system stay in place for a long time. I mean, people work at the CIA or the NSA or the DOD, you know, their entire life.
You know, it, getting into the systems thing more, I found it interesting. You mentioned renditions. You know, if we could get into it a little bit, where does this whole thing of renditions versus extraordinary renditions come from? I know you cover that quite a bit in the book.
Yeah, and that really comes out of the whole, you know, the point Duffy just made too about these folks that stay in these agencies for long periods of time, and if they're part of the spy agencies, they have this special privilege where you know, the media. Will almost never tell you. You'll see these reports and it'll say like the CIA found X or provided this report, but you never really get like the who were the players in the office and like, you know, how did they like their coffee kind of stuff, right? And renditions really comes down to personalities inside the berth of the Alex Station office. Because there's this guy named Michael Scheuer. And some might know him. He may be most famous for how much he hated John Ioffe, to the point where at one point, years later, he was testifying to Congress, and he said that the only good thing that happened on 9/11 was when the towers fell on John O'Neill. And then he just sort of blinked and stared at the congressman until they moved on to their next question. But this guy was a dude who... So the counter-terror department was pretty overlooked at CIA at the time, and the folks who thought there was anything to Bin Laden in the years after the 93 bombing were really not part of the important players at CIA who were getting the big budgets, right? And so in 93, after the World Trade Center bombing, Richard Clark. See, again, this is a great instance where there's a lot of times where you might point to Richard Clark and say, aha, he's a good guy. But in this instance, he was the guy who came up with the idea for reinstating renditions. It had not been done very often. There was one that he remembered from when he was working within the Reagan administration State Department, where the idea of a rendition was that you send a team in, probably some tough dudes, to just grab somebody somewhere in the world. Who has been fleeing justice, but a rendition, an ordinary one, the original renditions where you grab them and you bring them back to stand trial in court. So they're running somewhere in the U.S. You can't get the to go arrest him. So instead you just snatch him. So there was at least a legal you know, there was some sort of legal veneer because the end of the process would still see the guy being confronted by evidence of his wrongs by his accusers. But with Extraordinary Renditions, what happened was, you know, Richard Clark in 93 pitches this to Bill Clinton and Al Gore. There's a particular guy who's on the run. I think it was related to the 93 World Trade Center bombing. And there was concern about him. And I think Al Gore's quote was, you know, it's a no-brainer. I realize it's illegal, but so what? That's why it's a covert op. Let's go grab his ass. However, what they started to realize in the ensuing couple of years was that it wasn't always convenient. Like, there wasn't always a case to be mounted against these people, but there were people in CIA or people at the White House who would be concerned about a particular terrorist or alleged terrorist, accused terrorist, and they would need to sort of take care of them. They would just want to get the threat off the table without having to present any evidence. So what Mike Scheuer, who was kind of this nobody who had worked Soviet issues until the Cold War kind of ended, and he was sort of left out there without much you know, for him to do at the agency, but he had a counter-terror background, and he managed to get a deal now with a few countries, but initially it was Egypt, correct, John?
Yeah.
He works out a deal with Egypt that they're going to start taking these guys. They're notorious for just sort of holding people regardless of legalities, and they're also notorious for torturing them, and that was fully understood at the time when Scheuer works out this deal. The idea is that now there's somewhere for the Clinton administration when they're concerned about a particular guy, or the CIA when they're concerned, they can disappear them to Egypt. And that's when it becomes an extraordinary rendition. Extraordinary renditions really were an idea of Richard Clark that were executed by a guy who really hated him and who he hated, Mike Scheuer at CIA. And because Mike was able to get that cemented and they were able to disappear inconvenient individuals around the world to countries like Egypt that would hold them, he was given Alex Station. So that's the birth of the Bin Laden unit at CIA, was this backwater place where this one guy, Mike Scheuer, was rewarded for this terrible illegal idea, completely against any sense of of human rights. And so he has this woman, Alfreda Bukowski, an old friend of his who'd also worked on Soviet issues and who was also sort of completely unknown at the time and was ambitious. And he has her staff the entire office, and she staffs it with initially 25, eventually 50 of her friends. They're all people who've never worked out in the field. They from what they call, you know, the intelligence side, the analyst side. So they're a bunch of like bookworms. Most of them are in their late 20s. Some are as old as their early 30s. They're just not terribly experienced. And the few that notice Alex Station at the time take note of the fact that they all have this really strange devotion to Scheuer. And then those people start to refer to this particular unit as Scheuer's Manson family.
And it's mainly women in the Alex Station too, right?
It is, which is where the whole, the kind of, you know, possibly sexist kind of harem, you know, vibe that some of the, you know, there's two sides to CIA. There's the folks that go out in the field and they recruit spies, and they're sort of, their asses are sort of on the line if they were to ever get caught. And then there are the folks back at headquarters that are analysts, and some of these analysts are also out in the field, but they tend to be work from the office, right? And so the spies that are the assets that they've recruited that are feeding back information through these spy recruiters, through these officers in the CIA, that information has to get processed, and somebody needs to figure out what it all means and turn them into reports. And so these women were all analysts on that side. And so the guys who were like tough spies were sort of starting to, they were a little bit, they tended, the reputation that they had was for being sexist. In fact, in the mid-90s, this might seem like a bit of a segue, but in the mid-90s, there was actually a lawsuit by a number of women at the agency about sort of sexist hiring practices. So Scheuer, I guess, went against that grain, which, you know, might have been considered a good thing. The important part was not so much, though, that they were women, which is what I think the critic inside CIA at the time focused on, but that they were incredibly young and inexperienced, and being analysts, had no idea what they were doing in the sense of involved in recruiting assets within Al-Qaeda or running a real op.
Yeah, the only reason I mentioned the that they were female thing is I was clarifying, because I guess that makes the Manson family of the CIA thing seem more like it makes more sense.
And some of these women, it turned out to be pretty tough, and in some cases had no problem doing just as terrible of things as some of their male counterparts had over the years.
Well, the important thing for me with the Alex station is when it was I guess found, it was 1996. So I mean, people think that extraordinary renditions are just this thing that just happened in the Bush era, but again, we see that like there's a history to this stuff that reaches back, you know.
Well, what ended up changing after 9/11 was what the CIA wanted was to be let off the leash, to be able to start just acting without having to go and seek approval for every little thing. So an extraordinary rendition would have been pretty rare before 9/11. It happened, but it was one of those things that required, it required being signed off on, I think, at the presidential level. And after 9/11, this big executive order that Bush signs after George Tenet goes to Camp David and does this huge pitch on like, we need this, we're gonna go kick ass and take names, but you need to let us do this and that. One of those things, one of the crux of it was just that they wanted to be able to act without having to go and ask permission every single time.
Right, and it's it's interesting. I wanted to sidetrack just a second here with regards to Michael Schur. It's fascinating to me because a lot of people have sort of taken him up as, you know, this he's the anti-war on terror guy since he doesn't like the foreign interventions that we've been doing. But it's weird because he's actually like extremely hawkish in ways. Like he's for the torture programs. He thinks if we're going to be in a war on terror, we might as well go all out scorched earth on these countries that are involved in terrorism. Could you either of you elaborate on Schur and his sort of image and how it kind of differs from the reality?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know how people take him now. Or I'm sure there's people who, again, just because of political partisanship, get behind him. He's like a big Trumper dude. He's got a blog now where he writes about how patriots need to rise up to defend Trump from the FBI deep state or whatever.
Not just like he's like rise up like with their guns, not just rise up on Twitter.
I'm pretty sure he's just a Christo fascist. You know, he's one of these people who's like heavily influenced by a conservative Christian background and worldview. And, you know, there are things that he said in the past that were sort of right in small ways, but then his take was sort of crazy after the fact. But, you know, he was saying that the reason for Al-Qaeda's, attempt to aggress against the United States is because of our foreign intervention and our support in the Middle East and our support for Israel. And that's true. You know, like, that's exactly what, you know, bin Laden says. It's, you know, we're stationed in Mecca, we're interfering in the Islamic world, we're, you know, supporting Israel against the Palestinian people. So when Schur just like reports that, he's right. But then like Ray, or like you were saying, he has like this scorched earth vision where it's just like, okay, like if this is going to be, then we are in a war with Islam, and it's not a war we can win without, you know, going full bore. And he definitely phrases it as like essentially a war with Islam. I think he may have said extreme Islam or something. But
I think Schur, but I mean, he's like such an interesting dude because I could just start laying out a bunch of weird little facts about him that either like we found or others found, but you sort of collect them all together and like, you know, for instance, I don't think that he's almost the poster child for why there's not so much, you know, these people who believe in a quote unquote deep state. There's not like a deep state. There's just like all these sort of like fighting factions. And if you kind of could follow closely enough, almost like the office politics of the federal agencies, you start to realize how they sort of like align. And neither of them are necessarily you know, neither or any of them are necessarily always like the good guys or the bad guys if you really look at their records, as John was kind of saying. I mean, with Scheuer, it's interesting because he got, you know, he founded the Bin Laden Station. He's widely acknowledged to be one of the few that got that accurately predicted that Al-Qaeda and Bin Laden were going to be a problem. So you might pat him on the back for that. But then you look at kind of how he operated. He got, you know, he was against George Tenet. So if you're one of these people who like is like, you know, an anti-Tenet, anti-Brennan person, then you're kind of like, OK, maybe, you know, Scheuer's kind of a good guy. But he sort of got off the hook for 9/11. And that was because Richard Clark pushed his friend George Tenet to fire this guy after the 98 embassy bombings. And we can tell this story about sitting in Jack Clunin, this FBI agent from the New York office's living room, and revealing to him something Scheuer had said to another reporter that apparently, you know, Scheuer had that Al-Hada house in Yemen, in the key Al-Qaeda switchboard. He had discovered it in 96, around the time they started Alex Station, and had not bothered to tell the FBI, John O'Neill, the New York office, about this for the years running up to the 98 embassy bombings, which is super significant because that was later found to be one of the key, you know, telephone hubs that was used by the planners, right? So Richard Clark, he's got a good instinct. He doesn't know Mike Scheuer withheld this from the FBI, but he knows that the 98 embassy attacks happened and he wants to kind of clear house and get some new blood in there. So he pushes Rich Blee in to take over. Now, Blee, unlike Scheuer, is like this sort of is one of those guys I mentioned. He's the spy masters. He comes from the operations side. He's been nothing but out in the field. In fact, he was the son of, you know, a Cold War CIA guy who also did, you know, a ton of field spy and spy master work. So where I'm going with this is Scheuer gets kind of let off the hook because Blee came in to replace him. And apparently no other folks within the CIA, no other offices wanted to take Scheuer for a period of months. So Scheuer just keeps coming in every day to the CIA library and hanging out. And he remains very close with Alfredo Bukowski. And the people in his office after he's fired from Alex Station, there's reports, as we put in our book, that some of them kept pictures of Scheuer above their desk like a shrine. And I mean, I don't know if you've ever kept photos of former bosses above your desk, JG. I certainly haven't. But that was the devotion that continued. And I think the allegation under the surface has always been that, you know, if they were involved in some withholding pre-9/11 from FBI, there may have been continued communication between, you know, the woman who was most in charge of the office under Blee, Alfredo Bukowski, the one that Scheuer had placed there, and Scheuer possibly right through to 9/11. I mean, we don't know. But the fact that Scheuer chose the staff that failed so spectacularly and cut to the end, or some of your audience who would follow the story might be shocked to learn that in recent years, Mike Scheuer married Alfredo Bukowski. So it raises a lot of questions about how close they remained in those 2 years that he was out of that office and how much information he had about whatever op Richard Clark and others allege may have been happening to flip those hijackers. And certainly he bears responsibility, even though he gets off the hook, for staffing the office that made so many of these monumentally terrible decisions that seem to have sort of enabled the ability of those attacks to end up succeeding. Probably not on purpose.
I was going to say that ties back too to John O'Neill, who I guess we probably should have mentioned it earlier, like exactly who John O'Neill was and like the spectacular end he met.
Yeah, I mean John was another guy who you look at him in a certain way, you can paint him as, you know, he really believed in the Constitution. You know, he trained his officers that anything they were ever to do with any terrorism suspects had to eventually be able to be aired in a court of law and not derail the case. So they had to be a little bit by the book. But, you know, he was also a guy who it was discovered after he died was cheating on his wife with not just one or two, but like multiple girlfriends. He was a big drinker. He was a guy that they describe as having big elbows, meaning that, he would really kind of like he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. Close with Richard Clark. So there was a bit of an alliance between Richard Clark and the Bill Clinton White House and John O'Neill as sort of like head of counterterror at the New York FBI. And they were getting, so under his leadership, they were able to like, they were mounting cases against these various 1990s terrorism plots that had happened, and some that had been successful where the people got prosecuted later, and others that they managed to arrest before the plots were successful. So he had a pretty good reputation, and some people thought he might be headed towards the head of the FBI. And while his stuff could get reported on by the press, and he made damn sure it did, because he would go out to a place called the Lanes on the Upper East Side, where like reporters and national security people would all kind of hang out for drinks, in Manhattan. And he knew how to work the media and sort of be his own best publicist, which was something a lot of his people kind of admired about him. But he, like Scheuer, like Richard Clark, like George Tenet, was among a very small club of people who understood the threat from bin Laden and al-Qaeda when the rest of the government was busy looking at other stuff and focused on other politics and things. So the great irony is that before... let's see here. At some point in the spring of 2001, he attends some meeting in Florida, conference for FBI guys, and he steps out to make a phone call, and when he comes back, he finds that his briefcase has disappeared. So it's mandatory, because there are, this is almost like a Hillary Clinton kind of a moment here, like, because there are sensitive documents within there that might have been exposed to, you know, the briefcase was recovered. It appeared to just be like a local burglar that was around that hotel, but there had to be an investigation. And the thing that did him in was in the summer of 2001, a party unknown who was aware of that investigation leaks it to the New York Times. And when that article runs, John O'Neill really realizes that his career, his rise, is going to be severely hurt by that. And he decides to go ahead and retire. You know, so this guy's big fish, you know, his great white whale was bin Laden, and he retires a month before 9/11. And what job does he end up with? And one of the great ironies of all time is head of security at the World Trade Center. So when bin Laden's attack is a success, those towers fall on him, as Mike Scheuer bragged about later. And that's his story. And there was a lot of devotion among the FBI guys in the New York office that worked for him. And so over the years, they, you know, in the initial years after 9/11, some of the first stories that came out about failures, when they did finally come out around two, were largely, in a case of bad luck for the FBI, centered around FBI failures in the run up to 9/11. So a lot of like O'Neill's former team of devoted people who had managed to arrest and bring so many of these al-Qaeda plotters to trial in the past. They were kind of, they looked like the ones who had screwed up, and they were largely pushed to the side. And because the CIA was so successful at keeping their own failure, and the fact that they had hidden information about two of these hijackers from John O'Neill and the New York FBI, for so long, you know, the stories didn't start to come out really about the CIA in a significant way until 05 or 08. They've come out in the drips and drabs so long after the fact that really that original assessment about John O'Neill and his FBI stuck for a long enough time that those people's careers largely were ended by the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, and the reason I mentioned O'Neill is because of, you know, I guess the narrative around him is that he was sort of this guy that got stonewalled, essentially. And you know, the stonewalling and whistleblowing play a huge role, I would say the biggest role in Watchdogs Don't Bark, because part of what you guys are getting at is, you know, we don't just have a war on terror now. We have a war on whistleblowers. Could you guys comment on that?
Let's see how. Yeah. So there were various individuals. There was Mark Rossini, who worked at the FBI in the New York office under John O'Neill. There was John Kiriakou, who worked for the CIA, and he did counterterror work. He was involved in the arrest about Bouzid Baida in Pakistan. There was a strike at the NSA, along with other NSA staff like Kurt Wiebe, Bill Binney. And basically, you have a handful of these so-called whistleblowers we cover in the book who, for whatever their individual reasons, at their individual agencies, saw something going on that needed to be told. In Mark Rossini's case, which is very interesting, he had been detailed to Aleph Station at the CIA prior to 9/11. So when cable traffic was coming in about these Al-Qaeda dudes coming to the U.S., him and his another FBI detailee who was there, Doug Miller, who still works for the FBI, were trying to get this information passed over to the New York FBI, and they were told to hold off, and a whole series of escapades goes around that. So a few years later, when Mark Rossini finally retires, he goes on a PBS Nova special, and he starts talking about this. He starts talking about how this information was intentionally withheld by the CIA. He had actually told it to Lawrence Wright as well, who wrote about it in a book called The Looming Tower. Later, he would end up getting investigated for some misuse. Basically, he ended up getting charged with misuse of like official FBI computers. He describes it that he kind of, when he saw how following the rule didn't get anyone anywhere, he just kind of stopped caring in a certain sense. So when he had a girlfriend who was in, had a friend in some legal trouble, he did a few computer searches at work. But then it was made into a big deal and he was charged with this.
When Duffy says stop caring, I mean, he was one of those who had been incredibly close and sort of hand-groomed by John O'Neill and was sent to Alex Station to be John O'Neill's eyes and ears. So, he was riddled by guilt and he lost, his friend and mentor as a result of following the rules of not reporting because the CIA told him not to report to his friend.
Yeah, and also the guilt in general of the success of the 9/11 attacks. Because he kicked himself because he could have easily just said, fuck it. And, he went back to the New York office every Friday. He could have just walked in there one day and been like, yo, guys, guess what I saw over there? These two dudes are coming over, And he's basically was feeling a lot of guilt after that, probably still does to this day, because he never mentioned it. Because, again, he was not allowed to tell, so he didn't. Then John Kiriakou is this guy. He worked at the CIA. He loved working at the CIA. He ended up being offered to take part in the torture program, which a bunch of these other counterterror agents were running and getting involved in. And he was like, I don't think that's a good idea. It went against his personal values. He talked to one of his mentors at the agency who was like, these people, it's very likely they're going to end up in front of a congressional hearing one day being investigated for this torture. I wouldn't get involved in this. So, Kiriakou was like, yeah, that's a bad idea. I thought that was a bad idea. But then, again, years later, he's out of the agency. He goes on ABC News and he talked about the torture program at the CIA. And even in his own mind, like, he thought he was sort of doing right by the CIA because he was trying to defend it. At the time, he had, though he thought it was immoral, he had thought that it had worked because sort of the rumor around work in the halls was that it had been working. So that's what he had heard. And so that's what he said on TV. He later read the torture report and realized that that was all a bunch of lies, and that they weren't getting any good information no matter how many times they waterboarded these people. But it then came to pass that years later, he's in the private sector. He runs into another former CIA officer who's also in the private sector. The guy hands him business cards, and then a media reporter calls Kiriakou and asks him some questions about former employees there, and he hands off this business card. All he did was hand a business card of a guy who's out of the agency to a reporter. And essentially, he then gets prosecuted for that they're basically saying he's, like, violating the Intelligence Identity Protection Act, things like that.
As an aside there, John, I think both those cases John just mentioned are ones where, they got Mark Rossini on something he actually did. He did violate the rules. And look at FBI case files that weren't part of his cases, and he did, leak them to a prosecutor. So that was true. And same thing, John Kiriakou. I mean, it was complete bullshit to call it espionage, but he did give some names of people that he worked with that he knew had been undercover at one time to a reporter. But was that really – in both cases, there are questions about whether – what they got them on was sort of phishing, right? And John Kiriakou points to a book that makes the case that almost – there's so many laws out there that almost every individual, if you were studied on a day-to-day basis, would be found to have committed. And the idea being that one of the methods that it appears that happens is if you cross empire, the timing of Mark Rossini You know, he had already been investigating for 6 months on that pulling of, you know, files issue, and nothing had come of it. Then he decides he's going to talk to James Bamford about what the CIA ordered him not to pass before 9/11, and suddenly that prosecution moves forward. You know, John Kiriakou reveals torture, and it was all over the news in the days afterwards that he confirms torture anyway. It was, you know, in the news afterwards that the folks at CIA were hopping mad, and John told us in the book that he was aware that the push for his prosecution was not coming from the Justice Department on that issue of those names to the reporter that he gave. It was coming from two individuals in particular within the Counterterror Department of CIA. So it paints a little bit of a picture as to how this is done when somebody blows the whistle on something that needs the whistle blown. But continue, John.
But yeah, I mean, I don't want to like base our book, but yeah. So I think you summed that up nicely. Essentially, there were people who were on the inside who saw something bad going on and tried to talk about it after the fact. And it was after talking that some minor other thing that they did was blown up into a huge issue to try to prosecute them. And that's how they go after people. If you read the book, see the case of Thomas Drake, it's another famous case, and his case influenced Edward Snowden and his actions and such like that. So,
and I mean, you know, it's just like when you compare what John Kiriakou at CIA did to what Alfredo Bukowski is alleged to have done, not once, twice, but dozens of times throughout her career. It's pretty amazing. She was actually called by the pseudonym Jane Mayer, dubbed her the unidentified queen of torture, because more than, you know, John mentioned the fact that John Kiriakou for years believed that torture against Zubaida and others waterboarding had worked. Well, she's a prime suspect as to why he believed that and why so many believed it, including possibly the president, because when the Senate torture report finally came out in 2015, I think, she was mentioned three dozen times in it. And apparently part of the reason it took so long for that report to come out was because the senators had to negotiate with the Obama White House over the reaction of her particular name, because it had appeared so many times. Apparently some in the Senate felt that the name should have remained included, and it ended up being argued that it never was included in there. But so you've got this woman who misleads Congress and possibly the president and possibly many in her own agency for many years. You talk about stovepiping. It's when the information coming in from a secret black site is only going through a few hands at Alex Station or Alex Station's successor, and you've got people who are willing to sort of leave out the details that don't suit their own political inclinations, what they want to see happen for the country or for policy, and they only provide the other details that seem to support those things, then the tail can really wag the dog. And that was what happened in Bukowski's case. Yet, as Kiriakou told us, people like her rose and rose and rose in a very short amount of time. They've got these labels for government people, where you'll go GS-12, GS-13, GS-14. At some point, you jump into another sector of labels that's like the SESers, the executives, right? And to rise to the executive levels that some of people like Bukowski and those around her did, the way he put it was, unless you're Colin Powell, it just doesn't happen. You know.
I think the greater point here is that, yeah, if you look at a lot of these people, you could find lies, outright crime, perjury, like George Tenet lied before the 9/11 commission. And if you are committing these lies, committing these crimes, but it is furthering the general goals of the agencies and of the state, then you're going to probably be able to get away with it. You're going to be able to dance between the raindrops, right? But anyone who starts telling the truth, exposing those lies, exposing those crimes, but going against the interests of the agencies, of the state, then they will do whatever it takes to railroad you.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, to me, that's the core of the book in a lot of ways, is it really highlights discussions I've been having with people where people, especially people I know that are not in the U.S., that are overseas. I've had people overseas say to me, when do you think the U.S. will go back to normal? As in, there's been just problems, an assault on civil liberties since 9/11. There's been all these cases of whistleblowers being sort of gagged. you know, the rise of just a mammoth national security state, which people like yourself and James Bamford have covered. And, you know, to me, I'm not sure we're going to go back to normal. I think we're living in the new normal. And for me, that's sort of what Watch Dogs Don't Bark really gets at the heart of.
I don't know what is normal for America. Like, I don't think we are ever some what we claim to be. I think there's been the PR face of America, and then there's been what, like, actually goes on. And perhaps what the biggest change is that there's like a pride in our viciousness at this point, where before there was probably
it's
a
in
lot
your
of
face now.
Yeah, there was a lot of, you know. I mean, this is a country that had segregation in it running up into the 60s. You know, I think the last law prohibiting interracial marriage wasn't, like, repealed until 71 or something like that. I mean, we still have, you know, we rest on a genocide of the people who were here before us, and the poorest counties with the highest suicide rates and the highest drug rates and are still the Indian reservations. I mean, there's so much crap in our history that's been terrible, but there was always this, like, veneer of, like, we're trying to get better, and we're trying to get better, and we're trying to get better, and, like, this idea that there was going to be this social progress on these issues. But, I mean, we've been – show me a 10-year block of time when the U.S. wasn't at war with someone. To say go back to normal, I don't know what that normal would be, but maybe right now we're just more honest about how shitty we are at times. And I'm not saying we're entirely shitty. I mean, there are – come out of the United States, there are good people who live here, and there are people with great intentions who want to see things get better. But, like, the core thrust of, like, the government and all its connected agencies and industries has always been pretty brutal and pretty violent.
Now, see, I mentioned earlier that I'm more of, let's say, the optimist or the naive one, I think, as compared to John. And I don't disagree with anything that John just said, but I do think there were some fundamental changes that happened after 9/11. And I don't think they had to happen. I think if someone besides George W. Bush had been in, they might not have all gone the way that they went. And I'll give a few for instances. There were sporadic instances of torture by people in the U.S. government over the years, but it was never official U.S. policy. And there were certainly a number of instances I know some have documented where, like, the NSA had an earlier program to go through mail, and no question that the FBI targeted people like MLK and other activists and collected you know, communications in a way that was not cool. But the difference was that whenever this was discovered, that was always understood to be criminal. And so there was a high price to be paid potentially for anyone who engaged in this within the government and got caught. What changed after 9/11 is that we in an official policy of secretly monitoring the U.S. populace's own communications. That was a new thing. That was a definite major shift on the issue of privacy. And then when Ed Snowden, and, you know, really before him, folks associated with the NSA 5 like Bill Binney and Tom Drake, when they exposed this program, what we saw for the first time is instead of this, like, coming to the light of day and then us, like, prosecuting the people who were involved for being, you know, for violating the Fourth Amendment, it's just continued. We've sort of just resigned ourselves to the fact that I guess the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply anymore. And all this is like a dangerous, you know, the old term slippery slope. I mean, I would have never known how steep that slope was, but we've moved in a very, I would say things have gotten far worse, far quicker than I ever would have suspected. And unfortunately, I see small signs of hope in the fact that everyone in America seems to now be awake that there are problems in the country. But as to how that leads us to put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak, I don't know.
Well, you know, I think what I mean when I say the new normal is the war on terror is this war that, I mean, it's the endless war, essentially. I don't know. You can't. How do you fight a war on terror? It's not like you're fighting against nation states. And it's created this pretext for the endless growth of the national security state. This security state it will inevitably keep escalating as long as we have this sort of endless war.
I would I'm not saying you or Ray are wrong, because there's definitely truth to that. But I also, sometimes I think people look at their own time period and they start to see it as extraordinary and or like an aberration. And there are things that are different. There are very specific things that can be pointed to that are definitely because, you know, outgrowths of 9/11. But, you know, the signing of the National Security Act back in 1947 that created the CIA in the first place basically turned the United States into a national security state. And, you know, Gore would have to write about this and all the time because he was like a Jeffersonian who missed the death of the Republic. But, you know, they started the Cold War. Like, how were they ever going to win the Cold War? They were fighting what? The spread of global communism. I mean, they decided to go start, like, hot land wars and overthrow democratically elected leaders in countries because people had chosen a different economic system for themselves. So, you know, we had that what seemed to have been at the time an endless war. But then after the Soviet Union went bankrupt and, you know, in 1989, all of a sudden it was like, oh, shit, we don't have that anymore. This justification to keep the CIA going, to keep these intelligence agencies going, to keep spending money on tanks and fighter jets and aircraft carriers and all. Like, it started to seem like we didn't have to do that anymore. And that's, you know, going back to the beginning of this discussion, that's why George Tenet was standing on that stage in Ann Arbor in the 90s, defending the existence of the CIA. And now that we have, the war on terror, it just sort of replaced the Cold War. It's the justification. It's the justification for, you know, now we just have some new tech. So this domestic spying program that, you know, warrantless wiretapping, the collection of the metadata, yes, it is bad. It's not a deviation from the sort of the consciousness of the people involved in running the empire. It's just a new face of it because we have this new technology to which they are now applying their devious, you know, mindset. So this is kind of normal for the U.S., at least going back to post-World War II. I mean, we've been a national security state since that time.
One thing that gives me a little bit of hope, but I don't know, more people than ever before, and it's because of the internet. I don't think anybody could argue otherwise. The internet has allowed a spread of information that is creating a slow-moving revolution, and we still don't know exactly which way that's heading. And I think a lot of people have pointed could be heading to very dystopian times or very utopian. Right now it's not looking that utopian, but maybe it's the dark before the clouds clear. I don't know. But I think like we've had the wool pulled over our eyes and the same set of tricks seem to be used over different eras over and over again. And because we're so bad at understanding our history and because Americans for so long were completely unskeptical and willing to sort of believe what they were told, they could get away with that. And I hope that one thing that our book helps with in some small way is that if you read the book, I think you do start to figure out some of the tricks to the tail wagging the dog and you know, how the system operates. And then, I don't know, maybe when people catch on in a wide way to how those tricks happen, then they just come up with a new set of tricks. I don't know. But people are more skeptical than they've ever been. And it's almost to a place where I'm concerned about it going the other direction, where there are people who don't believe anything that comes out in the media, period. And it almost seems like they're just going to give over their critical thinking function and just call everything fake news. Whereas I would advocate for, self-education and a bit better understanding of media literacy, as well as like intelligence literacy, like realizing when the outlines of bullshit are very clearly there based on prior instances. And then also, by the way, I would say that no matter what your political beliefs, I would hate to see the politicizing of whistleblower support happen. And it has to some extent. People pick their which whistleblowers they're going to support depending on which president that whistleblower is opposing. And I think people really, no matter your political inclinations, need to, for instance, get behind Reality Winner right now, who's somebody who's been really under reported on and under supported and needs it. And every time somebody risks themselves to expose a truth that the state doesn't want exposed, they're doing us a favor. They're our friend, if only because they were willing to tell us something that nobody else was willing to stick their neck out and tell us, you know?
I think that would be a great note to end on, but I do want to give you guys I want to give you guys the last word, what you want readers to get out of Watch Dogs Don't Bark.
And by the way, it's Watch Dogs, the Watch Dogs Didn't Bark. I'd hate to throw off the Google search.
my apologies.
That's all right. And they can find us at on Twitter at it's at Watchdogs Book. You kind of follow all our latest developments. If I could just know about what they could get out of it, I'll leave the last word to Duffy. But I wanted to make sure anybody who hung on for this whole thing, thank you. We appreciate you listening to our point of view on this. Hope you'll check out the book. We wrote it because we couldn't possibly say everything we wanted to say on this and wanted to sort of lay this story out that runs from the late 80s to 2015. And please, for the love of God, if you like the book, go write a review on Amazon. If you know somebody who's a reviewer, you know somebody in the media, if you can tweet about this, please help us get the word out. It's not just about the book, but people who are not getting reported about in the media that we report about in the book. And the more people that know about this, I think hopefully it'll have some positive effects.
Yeah, I don't want to go into like a rant or a tirade, but here I go. Oh, I'm just kidding. The history that we chronicle in there, we couldn't have done without the work of many other people, a variety of journalists working for certain major media outlets, a lot of people who write, you know, things in print, people who've written books. So first and foremost, you know, we owe them a debt of gratitude for even getting to complete this. And I mentioned them too, because like Ray said, we don't want to swing so far that we are unwilling to believe anything at all that we hear and just cry fake news anytime the news happens to say something we don't like. We need as a population to be, have a good bullshit detector, but make sure it's pointed in all directions. It's a weird position in that we're in because this tale, you know, obviously has 9/11 as a central event. And there are people who think we are too, way too conspiratorial, even though we're like, we're talking to all the people who like worked at these agencies and asking what was going on. Like, this isn't a conspiracy. Like, we're getting like the firsthand. This is just reported. And it might point to a conspiracy in the sense that there is a, you know, active group of people breaking, you know, keeping law breaking secret. But, you know, we're not just making things up. And then there's this other group of people who are super fascinated by the 9/11 topic, but if you even acknowledge that there is something called Al-Qaeda or that there were hijackers, or, you know, they immediately go like, ah, shill, you know, he's limited hangout, you know, and they think that we're working for these, you know, groups to paint like a false trail or something. So it's a weird position to be in, and it just takes a bit of, you know, a bit of patience and a bit of, yeah, like a good bullshit detector when you're reading the news, when you're listening to the news. And also just when you're approaching politics or government in general, and like the book, you know, I tried to do with the book was to say, you know, it's easy for people who work in these agencies to find their way to hack the technology of accountability. So a system, a political system, a government agency, you know, these are technologies. When people find ways to work together and to organize, that is a social technology. And these elements that exist to try to hold people accountable so that bad things don't happen or so that bad actions are punished, like, they learn the workarounds, you know. So to just sit and think that because we have these elements in place that no one can do wrong or that it will be caught just really isn't true. And I feel that we have to, every time we say like, oh, we support the existence of this agency, you have to understand there are going to be people who learn how to manipulate it towards their own ends. So we have to be skeptical of power in general, and, you know, people can do with that what they may, but
And one last thing, you know, when we started on this journey, you know, we were 20 when 9/11 happened, and you know, we started working on our first documentary around this, and that rolled into the next thing, and here we are with this book. There weren't folks like you, JG, and that's another thing that gives me a lot of optimism. Thank you for having us on, and I'm happy that there have been the podcasts and the outlets and the audience that's skeptical and hungry for real reporting and alternate points of view and so on and so forth, because when we started this, we really had to, if we were going to get this message out, we had to rely on the New York Times or the Washington Post and try to convince somebody over there to run an article. And, you know, I think earlier in the podcast, I mentioned that we wrote this book because we couldn't believe, you know, these years since 2011, when the name Alfreda Bukowski dropped, that these major media had not covered her incredible story. since our book dropped on August 28th, I continue to be astounded that the major media don't see anything of interest here to report on, with the exception of Newsweek and Salon and a couple places. I'm sure you've got a very educated audience out there, and I'm sure it may include some folks that run in the circles of outlets like that. And I would just throw the gauntlet down. Who has the courage to report on these people and these stories that we've put in our book? There you go.
And you know what? I know I said I'd give you guys last comment, but I wanted to say real quick, John, you mentioned the sort of conspiracy thing. I've always found it weird, all the work you guys have done, from 9/11 Press for Truth to Who is Richard Blee to this book. I don't see it as being part of that conspiracy milieu. You guys aren't talking about missiles hitting the Pentagon. You're not talking about holograms or even controlled demolition claims. Your guys are dealing with intelligence failures that, you know, even now, there's people in the 9/11 Commission that admit that the 9/11 Commission wasn't able to do a proper investigation. So I think you guys are doing good work, and I don't think it's conspiracy theory.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the 9/11 story is huge. I mean, there's so many angles to look at. We have really honed in on a certain chunk of it, and I think I'm proud of the things we've gotten done. The 9/11 Commission barely even looked at like the NSA at all, you know, and there's so much there. So I mean, there's no way it could have gotten to the entire truth. So, you know, this idea that we just need to like look at that final report and say that's all there is, I mean, it's a starting ground.
I want to thank you guys again.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, I want to thank you guys, too, for coming on Parallax Views.
Appreciate it, man.
Well, that does it for this 9/11 18th anniversary edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found my conversation with Ray Novoshowski and John Duffy, authors of the excellent, highly recommended The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, The CIA, NSA, and the Crimes of the War on Terror, to be fascinating. And to be honest, I hope it infuriated you to hear about the absolute failures of the national security state in the lead up to and aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. 18 years on, where is the accountability? Where is the justice? It's something that aggravates me, folks. And I really, really want people to check out the book, The Watchdogs Didn't Bark, because it will make you rage with indignation at what wasn't done to prevent 9/11 and how those who weren't able to stop the horrible events of that day were not disciplined for their failures. Not only that, we now have a national security state that is out of control. We have a war on whistleblowers, the erosion of civil liberties, endless wars, and the beat goes on. So folks, on this 9/11 anniversary, I would like you to think about that. I got nothing else to say. If you want to support the Patreon, go ahead. Check out Ray and John's work. They're still on Twitter. Watchdogs Didn't Bark. Check it out, folks. It's still important. It still matters. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.